Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm here in Denver, Colorado this evening with my partner, Larry Mishkin from Chicago, who is in town for a few days.
I am, Jim. Nice to see you as always. Nice to be in Denver and have a chance for us to catch up and actually tape our show together. Although I prefer to be out at the barn, I'm happy to see you here at the Hoban office.
Very good. And we have a guest today?
We do. We have a special guest with us, Kevin Pilarski. Kevin is with the Revolution Group. They're out of, based in Illinois. They're a multi-state operator now and have done very, very well for themselves on the marijuana side. And Kevin was kind enough to join us today, and he's going to answer some of our questions and give us some of his thoughts, both on the new adult use program we have in Illinois, and then on the hemp side of things. Revolution is taking a look at that as well, and he has some thoughts to offer.
Excellent, excellent. And in addition, we let him on the show because he also has some Grateful Dead credentials. So, Kevin, tell us, when was your first Grateful Dead show?
Got to believe that it was probably 1985 at Soldier Field. I've seen more Dead and Company, other ones, the Dead shows that I've seen, Grateful Dead shows. I think I only saw Jerry maybe half a dozen times.
Sure. Okay. But did you get to the Fairly Well 50th?
Absolutely. I was there for all three.
Okay, Larry and I was there as well.
Yeah, sure.
Wonderful shows. I'll never forget that second song when they broke into Jack Straw.
That's good.
And the ripple just went through that entire stadium.
And Trey did a good job.
I love Trey. Yeah. I'm a big Fish fan.
Yeah. So.
Absolutely. I thought he did do a very good job.
So, tell us about Revolution because, we're just a couple weeks into, 3 weeks into adult use in Illinois. Tell us what's going on.
So Revolution is a multi-state operator that was founded in Illinois in 2015. Like many other cultivators that came of age in Illinois, we had a rough patch when we went to a Republican governor. The program was stifled, I guess, for 4 years. We have finally crossed the 100,000 patient mark or close to it. And now that adult use is in place, things are humming, certainly across the entire state from a cultivating standpoint. Unfortunately, the quickness with which the law was passed and adult use was put into a place has caused some shortages. And that's something that I think all of the cultivators now are trying to work through right now. We're certainly building as fast as we can, and I know our friendly competitors are doing the same thing.
How would you say the prices are? What is an eighth of an ounce cost for adult use in Illinois?
So it's typically between $55 and $70 for an eighth. We've been very cautious about raising prices, even though our competition has done so. We've tried not to gouge the market the way that it might be perceived, especially on the medical side. We have only one dispensary in Illinois right now, and it is medical only. And so, a lot of our product goes to that medical dispensary, as well as the 55 other dispensaries that are there in the state. It's been interesting in that because of the shortage, there's been forward contracts on sales amongst many cultivators to different possible buyers. We've done a little bit of that, but have really tried to make sure that our product's distributed as evenly as we can across the state.
And what is the town and the address of your medical dispensary for the people listening out there?
So that's New Age Care. It's in Mount Prospect on Euclid Avenue. And again, it's medical only. So in fact, it's interesting. We've seen about a 24% increase in the first 3.5 weeks of January from a patient count standpoint,
yes.
Most of which have been medical patients from other dispensaries that went both medical and adult use that have come over because we fully stock our dispensary with our products.
Well, that's very interesting. As point of reference, Colorado has had adult use since 2014, and we still have over 100,000 medical patients on the rolls. Some of the reasons for that: better pricing, lower taxes, and the real key to it is 18 to 21 year olds can get a medical card.
Interesting.
Well, they have to be 21 to buy adult use.
Yeah.
So we've maintained, even with adult use in Colorado, a strong medical program, and our wholesale pounds for medical sell for more than our recreational pounds.
Interesting.
This is very interesting.
Well, we've really seen, you point this out, the medical, and yes, that As Kevin pointed out, we had a period of time, long period of time, where the market was very much stifled, and it was very, very frustrating. And for me, of course, the great irony is now that we have adult use, the patient population is exploding. But of course, for the reasons that you just set out, Jim, that it does provide for better pricing. You avoid the excise tax, which in Illinois ranges between 15 to 25%, depending on the product. And it does, it bounces the price up. And just my own very informal survey, I found that at the medical dispensary I go to, you could buy an eighth for generally around 60. But I went to the adult use near my home in Evanston, and they were selling the same eighth for 80. So, you know, there's definitely a difference in price. And, you know, people who have figured that out are jumping on board on the medical side all of a sudden.
Well, our CPA firm, Bridge West, has many adult use clients here in Colorado, and they would love to see those prices because we're at $20 to $25 an eighth here in Colorado, wow. Which for your business plan and revolution, you should plan on declining prices over time.
Absolutely. Our wholesale price today is somewhere between $3,500 and $4,000 a pound compared to Colorado, which is roughly $1,200 to $1,500 a pound. So we fully expect that as cultivation catches up with demand, that those prices will decrease. One of the tenets of what Revolution has done is we've only chosen to participate in markets where there are limited licenses. We feel that there's an advantage in limited license markets that are oligopolies, and they can provide for better margin protection. And that's what we'll continue to do on the cannabis side. But we fully expect that prices will come down over time.
But you're absolutely right about the limited license versus unlimited license. We have unlimited license here in Colorado. You can still walk into our marijuana enforcement division with a clean record and a check that clears and walk out with a license. So for valuation purposes, the states that have limited license, like Massachusetts, for instance, most recently Missouri, you find that those valuations of the companies are much higher.
True. We've just recently completed a cultivation facility in Arkansas that will be up and running February 1st. It's in the process of being inspected right now. And we also have four dispensaries in Arkansas. Again, a limited license market. It's similar to Illinois in that it's roughly a third of the population, but also a third of the licenses of Illinois. So, you know, we feel as though Illinois has been a good proxy for what we expect to see in Arkansas as well.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask is, you know, for all of the people talking about how, you know, the Illinois market never really took off very well, one of the things that's always struck me as interesting is the number of up-and-going and successful multi-state operators that are based in Illinois. And there's a few of you guys out there, you, and Cresco, and GTI. And is there any explanation for what caused this, people just saying, we're not going to be able to do in Illinois, so let's look nationally?
Well, I think those operators that started in Illinois realized that it was a tough road to hoe. And so they had to learn how to run their businesses efficiently from a capital standpoint, efficiently from a headcount standpoint. Like any good business, when you encounter problems, those that succeed are the ones that can overcome those problems. And I think that was kind of a Darwinian natural selection with companies that came out of Illinois as opposed to companies that have come out of other states. Now, having said that, there are still some great companies that I respect that have come out of other states. Columbia Care, Harvest are two that come to mind.
Sure.
That are both very well run and you know, I think are the cream of the crop. But it is interesting that a lot of the multi-state operators came out of Illinois, and I would attribute that to the fact that you know, those years in 2015 to 18 were pretty lean.
And what other states are you in besides Illinois?
We have operations in Arkansas, Illinois. We have a dispensary in Maryland, and we own a license in Florida that we're currently building out our facility there.
And what trade names do they go under?
Well, they're all under the Revolution Global trade name as a company. We have brands that we will continue to support in other states, both the Spectra brand, which is a derivative brand. It's where all of our derivatives are under that brand. We have you know, our Syrup brand, which is a liquid syrup that can be poured into drinks. Coffee especially has become very popular. We have a French vanilla brand that's part of that Syrup brand. It's very interesting to see that growth.
We'll steer the conversation a little different area. maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background and how that your background has brought you into some opinions on the CBD market. As I would like to say, you can't turn on the radio today without hearing a CBD commercial for CBD products.
Right.
Well, I'm a capital markets guy at the end of the day. My career has been a unique one, I guess, to say the least. It's certainly been in a lot of different areas. And I started as a derivative trader on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade and then ran derivative trading companies for the better part of a decade and then moved into the index business with Dow Jones and built an electronic trading business with Cantor Fitzgerald, eSpeed, and then most recently I was at PwC as a management consultant. So derivatives and capital markets are really my background. And when we started looking at the hemp market a year and a half, 18 months ago, my biggest concern was that there was no way to hedge the price of hemp into the future. So, you know, if you're a farmer today and you put corn in the ground, you can sell that corn forward and know that you're going to make a profit on it because you can sell it at some price, right? Similarly with beans or any agricultural commodity or even cattle and what used to be pork bellies, which was bacon. You know, you don't have that in the hemp market, and you don't have it because it's still a very nascent market compared to those other markets. The Chicago Board of Trade was founded in the mid-1800s, and it's been in existence for well over 160 years, primarily catering to the agricultural community.
But, is there a price smoothing mechanism?
Well, it's a hedging mechanism that allows for both the buyer and the seller to make sure that their pricing volatility is minimized. So, by example, if you're Kellogg and you want to make cornflakes, you know you got to buy corn and have it every month for the next year or 2 years or whatever. And therefore, the farmer can know what his price of corn will be in the future and may choose to hedge all or a piece of his crop. Now, a good statistic, I think, that we should keep in mind is the actual size of the hemp market relative to other agricultural markets. The hemp market last year, we did 80,000 acres. There were roughly 550,000 acres registered this year. Maybe 200,000 to 250,000 of those were actually grown. So that's 250,000 acres nationally. In Illinois, we did 11 million acres of corn alone, and we have 20 million acres of agricultural tillage that is spread between corn, beans, wheat, alfalfa, hay, but primarily corn, beans, and wheat. So when you look at 250,000 acres versus 20 million in the state of Illinois alone, you can see that hemp is still quite a de minimis crop when it comes to its effect on national and global markets.
And some of the things I've seen, because at Bridge West we have several dozen CBD and hemp company clients and farmers, is, you know, they did their harvest in September, early October of 2019. A lot of that crop is still sitting, and prices are very, very low compared to what a year ago was $40 to $60 a pound. And we're hearing prices in the $5 to $10 a pound range this year. But my opinion is there won't be another harvest now until next September, October nationally. So won't we see prices tick up and that product get absorbed into the marketplace and absorbed into all those CBD products that you hear advertised on the radio?
We very well may. In larger, more established markets, when prices bottom out, they tend to take 12 to 18 months to come back. Now, having said that, last year we saw prices of biomass spike again pre-harvest. So you think about the June, July, August timeframe was when biomass was at its peak. But most farmers had expected to get somewhere between $3 and $4 a percentage point on CBD, and now they're lucky to get 50 cents to a dollar. And I think if you look at, some of the, there's a couple different services out there, hemp benchmarks being one of them. There's another exchange here in Denver that's trying to get going. You can see, what the benchmark pricing is, not only nationally, but also on a localized basis. And it's important because hemp market doesn't have the infrastructure that other agricultural markets have, so a national price is oftentimes misleading. It tends to be much more localized based on the extraction capabilities of that local market, as well as the ability to move the product from state to state. We know that there was some trouble with that last year, although I think that's being worked out.
Unless you're in Idaho.
Right.
Well, there's still some issues there. One of our clients sent some biomass through the mail to be tested, and it got flagged.
Sure. So, but what we're finding with that is that this is just a byproduct, once again, of a lack of education. Law enforcement, they don't know what they're dealing with, and they admit freely. I had a situation earlier this year where a client of mine had CBD products shipped into them from Washington State to sell here in Illinois. They were flagged at the local FedEx place. The Chicago police came and picked them up. I went down to try and get them, but we can't give this to you, counsel. It's cannabis. So we had to go through the whole, no, it's simple. We tested it, and it has THC in it. Well, eventually, after, you know, far too many telephone calls and visits down with the Chicago police, I finally got somebody who understood what we were talking about. And 3 weeks later, they gave my client the product back. And, of course, he had incurred legal fees along the way and no products on his shelf for 3 months. But it is kind of a slow process in that regard. And for people in the industry, it's, I tell them, if you're going to sit down and get involved in CBD, I think the most important part of the contract right now is transportation. Who's going to take the risk on shipping? Because this is a real problem out there. You can't just assume that it's going to get from point A to point B.
And I think that it's a testing issue as well. Right?
Yes.
So, you know, smells the same, looks the same. You know, unless you've got a testing mechanism that can determine whether or not it's 0.3,
yes,
it's pretty difficult for any law enforcement agency to understand what it is on the spot.
Yep.
Now, that brings up a whole other question, which is, you know, the THC Delta 9 test versus the total THC test.
Yes.
Which is a big concern amongst farmers based on the latest USDA language.
Yes.
From a cannabis standpoint, we have products that will test at 0.3% Delta 9, but their THC, total THC, can exceed 30%.
Sure.
So once it's decarboxylated from THCA to THC Delta 9, you understand that it's really marijuana,
right?
However, you know, there's a lot of product that is being sold today as smokable hemp.
Yes.
That is over 0.3% total THC, but it may be under 0.3% Delta 9 because all that THCA that is in excess of 0.3 has not been heated to become, you know, the Delta 9 that has the psychotropic effect.
Right, which raises an interesting question altogether. As you know, if they're going to say that 0.3% is legal, then you're right. I mean, it really opens up some interesting possible up. It's 0.3% on paper and in the testing, but we all know that as soon as you put a match to it, then it's a whole different story. That's very true.
Well, speaking of regulation, the FDA and hemp as it relates to hemp, I don't believe any of us have seen in our lifetime a consumer product that you put in your body and has some effect on you medically with virtually no testing and no background. Kevin, I think you have some opinions on that.
I do. As a former hedge fund manager for a biotech company, I'm very familiar with the FDA process, and I find it difficult to believe that the FDA will approve CBD when a company has already gone through the FDA clinical stage approval process to get CBD approved as a drug, meaning GW Pharma and Epidiolex, right? They front-ran everyone, did all the necessary steps, and spent the millions of dollars to get the product approved and the compound approved. I don't see the FDA making an exception just because there's public demand out there. And having said that, they're under a lot of pressure to do something, but I just don't believe that the FDA is going to roll over because there's that public pressure. And I guess as a former trader and hedge fund manager and risk manager, you know, I think about that binary risk, right? The FDA can say no definitively, and you're out of business.
Right. That's right.
So you think some of these products that we see on the shelf today, we won't name them, but their shelf life could be severely limited by regulation.
Well, there's 3,500 companies right now that are peddling CBD products out there. That's the first issue you have. Second issue is there's no need or requirement for third-party testing. So you really don't know what you're getting in that bottle, right? Third, the economics on the retail side are unsustainable. And I say that because I went out and purchased a 5,000 milliliter bottle of CBD oil that was fully tested and was well respected in the market. And that was $390 for that bottle. Okay, 5,000 milliliters. That is the equivalent of 5 grams of CBD isolate in it. At the time, CBD isolate was trading at $5,000 a kilo. So that means there's $25 of CBD isolate in a product that's selling for $390. Today, CBD isolate is somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000.
A kilo.
A kilo, yes.
Yep.
And my point being that, you know, those prices at $390 aren't sustainable over time. Anytime you have margins that big, competition will come in.
Right.
What I do think is likely to happen is at some point, a pharmaceutical company will buy out some of the bigger names that are in the CBD industry today so that they have access to the product and the technology and the farmers and the whole supply chain that's necessary. But I don't see 3,500 CBD companies being successful over the next 2 to 5 years. I think that, like anything, there'll be consolidation. You know, I think one of the things that's interesting and what, you know, Revolution is looking at is, you know, the idea that farmers have taken on the hemp crop as a new revenue stream, but in some cases haven't made the kind of returns that they had hoped for on the CBD side. Our belief is that, you know, there's a lot of players in the CBD side, and that's probably not an area that we want to play in today, given the competition and the concern about risk with the approval process. But on the industrial side of hemp, whether it's the seed or fiber, you know, there's amazing opportunities there. If you just look at what has gone on in China and Europe since 1937, when we banned the hemp crop, you know, those markets have become robust. In China, they have a natural buyer for their hemp fiber in the People's Republic Army of China. All their uniforms are made of hemp.
Sure.
In Europe, interestingly enough, many German car manufacturers now have hemp body panels in their door panels and in their dashboards. Hemp being cheaper, lighter, and stronger than typical plastics. Now, it should be noted that they're not completely biodegradable because the technology to turn hemp into plastic, although we all hope for that, isn't there today. Roughly 20% of those body panels are still made of some kind of a polymer that is plastic or crude oil based. But we feel that as the technology moves forward, the opportunity set there is immense.
Well, as you and I know, Bob Hoban and the Hoban Law Group have been taking that position for a long, long time. And in fact, you and I talked about Bob's presentation that you heard out at MJ Biz this year. And it's a point that we really try to emphasize with our clients, because as you say, when you say that, look, you have different choices in terms of the product you can come up with your hemp, but one of them has to go through the FDA and one of them has all of these problems and we just don't know what the heck is going to ever happen with it. And I don't think we're going to have that problem making door panels for Ford or GM, you know, once they get the formulas worked out and how they want to do it. And really, I think that, and you guys are obviously smart enough to figure that out as well, that maybe hemp has a much larger life outside of the CBD.
Well, we think so. We think that you know, the margin compression on hemp, if it were to come, is you know, years, if not decades off. Think about the Chinese or the Europeans that have had from 1937 to 2019, right, roughly 70 years or 80 years there ahead of us, that we still need to play catch up on. If we were to produce the same amount of hemp that go into European cars today, we would need to build 30 decorticating plants in the United States to just match the demand that is currently in Europe just for auto parts. So the discussion here needs to be about scale,
right,
and not about, you know, a cottage industry that has, you know, 500,000 or 250,000 acres. I mean, we need millions of acres of hemp in order to make this successful on a mass level. And, you know, the fact that we're all much concerned about the environment and sustainability, even though those hemp door panels may not be fully biodegradable, at least you've got 80% of them, or 80% of the product that's going into it, which is, in fact, biodegradable.
Right.
And, you know, as the technology improves with polymers, we expect that we'll eventually be able to get to single-use plastics that are plant-based, right? It may be hemp, it may be corn, it may be, you know, orange peels for all I know. But without scale, you don't get the pricing to where it's competitive.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much. That was hugely insightful. There's so much. I think there's a lot more unknown than is known about CBD and hemp products at this point. So that was very interesting. Maybe we should talk a little music on our way out the door here.
We can do that.
So you have a show to go to tomorrow?
I am. Business never stops except when there's good music to see. And I was out here today for my meetings. And if the weather cooperates back in Chicago, I'll be back there tomorrow. And Off to see Tedeschi Trucks tomorrow night at the Chicago Theater. One of my favorite bands, as we've talked about, Derek Trucks, I think, is the bomb out there right now playing guitar. And quite frankly, if he wasn't on stage, we'd be saying the same thing about his wife. So it's a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to that because they're always going to put down a good show.
Yes. So it's interesting. We talked about my experience as a deadhead. My musical experience started with the Allman Brothers back in the late 70s. And, you know, the ability to see, well, I never saw Dwayne, but I saw Dickie Betts play probably 50 times. And so I started out as an Allman Brothers fan.
Yep.
And then, of course, when Derek, you know, joined the band, or Woody, or you know, I mean, there's lots of different players that have been through that band. But, you know, it was a natural progression for me to understand the musical talents of the Allman Brothers, and then that just naturally flowed into becoming a fan of the Grateful Dead.
Absolutely, and you're right. And I think, you know, they're just two sides of the same coin. And your comments about Dwayne Allman are well taken. And there are not many rock and roll legends who I regret not having seen live. He is certainly one of them. But by the same token, I think how incredibly lucky we are, because if there's anybody that's channeling his soul, it's Derek Trucks. And, you know, when Tedeschi Trucks and Trey did the Layla album at Lockin' last year, to me, that was, you know, you could close your eyes. Is it Derek? Is it Dwayne? Does it matter? It's just great guitar. And it's wonderful to see.
And I'll take this opportunity to plug a great documentary I just saw, courtesy of John Fishman from Fish. He does a serious radio show called The Errant Path.
Yep.
Wonderful. Totally eclectic. A great documentary called Muscle Shoals.
Oh.
And it has everybody in it, from Elvis to Martin Luther King to Dwayne Allman. One of the things about the Allman Brothers, and I'm a big Allman Brothers fan, and I was old enough to at least see on TV Dwayne Allman, and some great photos in Muscle Shoals of the young Allman Brothers band. But so many of the Allman Brothers songs that people don't understand were actually covers of old 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s blues songs.
Sure.
And Blind Willie Dixon was some of the ones they covered, and I can't think of them off the top of my head right now. But you think, oh, that's an original Allman Brothers song, but it's not.
Well, you know, listen, it was the same thing that the Grateful Dead did. But what both bands did is they took these songs and made them their own.
Yeah, so many of the songs that Grateful Dead were, who am I thinking of, Johnny Cash, and Merle Haggard.
Or even beyond that, like take a song like Stagger Lee, which, you know, depending on which book you look at, they got 50 different people who may have written it.
Yeah.
Or Greatest Story Ever Told. But yeah, you know, they took those songs and they put their own stamp on it. And
Or even the deck covering ZZ Top.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
What did song did ZZ?
They did Jesus Comes to Chicago.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Jesus Just Left Chicago.
Well, I'll do a couple of plugs here at the end. My next show will be Oysterhead. They'll be playing in the Denver area here next month. And so Stuart Copeland.
Sure.
From The Police on drums. And Trey Anastasio on lead. And then am I drawing a blank?
Les Claypool
on bass.
Sure.
So that'll be a lot of fun. And one more plug for our son Jack's band was just written up. Our son Jack plays in a Fish tribute band called Kings of Prussia.
Okay.
And they were just written up here in Westward, here in Music Magazine here in Denver.
Sure.
As an up-and-coming Fish tribute band.
Wow.
And they're getting 3 or 4 gigs a night as he finishes up college.
Okay.
And
that's exciting.
But his mother said, you cannot be a musician. You have to get a job. Use your college degree. You can't live on $50 a night as a musician.
Well, the Grateful Dead wrote a song about that, so we know day jobs. Yes, sir.
All right, everybody. I think we're coming to the end here. Anything else, gentlemen?
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity.
Kevin, thank you for joining us. Kevin Pilarski, Revolution. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Wonderful insight. Jim Marty here. Same.
Jim, a pleasure. I will look forward to coming out to Denver again soon to visit you one more time.
All right. Over and out from Denver, Colorado, and the Deadhead Cannabis Show. Goodbye, everybody.